attend at UW-Madison for a semester before going back home to recover from pneumonia, and subsequently entered, went to school at Queens College, where one of his friends and classmates was Paul Simon. And after this Paul Simon, in his budding career, wrote a song, "He Was My Brother." But we're going to sing the original, "Those Three Are On My Mind." I think of Andy in the cold, wet clay. Those three are on my mind. With his comrade beside him on that brutal day. Those three are on my mind. There lies young James in his mortal pain. Those three are on my mind. So I ask of the killers, can you see those three again? Those three are on my mind. But I am breathing yet, and for some the sky is bright. So I ask of those killers, can you sleep at night? Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. I see Dwight Michael with his blue-eyed bride. Those three are on my mind. And three proud mothers weeping side by side. Those three are on my mind. I see the tin roof shanties where my people live. Those three are on my mind. And the burned out churches where they sing we forgive. Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. While on the backwoods roads ride the hooded bands, poisoning the air from the southern lands. So I ask those killers, can you ever wash your hands? Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. They sit the mighty judges handing down the law. Those three are on my mind. In their marble courthouse we are filled with awe. Those three are on my mind. I know the price of liberty. But I must ask the question who burns in me. They also burn the courthouse where they killed those three. Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind.
There we go. Good morning, everyone. It is 4:00 here in the east side of Madison. So we are fortunate that we are able to present our service this morning via Zoom. Thank you all for coming this morning. Our community is a place that welcomes you. It's a space of love, support, justice, compassion, and fellowship. We are glad that you are here with us. Our chalice lighting today is by Albert Schweitzer. At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has a cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. So I now virtually light our chalice. Our opening words are found in our hymnal. It's a titled by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose 95th birthday will be celebrated tomorrow. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied to a single garment of destiny. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. There are some things in our social system in which all of us ought to be maladjusted. Hatred and bitterness can never cure the disease of fear. Only love can do that. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds which precipitate and perpetuate war. One day, we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. We shall hew out of a mountain of despair a stone of hope. For our opening music, we have hymn number 169, We Shall Overcome, accompanied by Mary Mullen, Barbara Park, and Dan Proud. Lyrics will be in the chat.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to sing We Shall Overcome. I think it's probably in the words are in your chat, so if you want to sing along, feel free. We're going to be doing verses 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then 1 again. And for the last time we go through it, we'll say today rather than someday.
Yeah.
He'll mute it.
Thank you, Dan, Barb, Mary. Our time for silent meditation begins now. I will ring a Buddhist gong to help us begin a moment of silent meditation. As we return from the silence, let me ask that you now help us begin the formal part of the service, because we have a video taken from YouTube that we hopefully will frame our presentations this morning. It is a short, brief biography of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Martin Luther King Jr. was born on January 15, 1929, and graduated as the valedictorian of Crozier Theological Seminary in 1951. King became pastor of a Baptist church in Montgomery, Alabama, and later completed his PhD.
Martin Luther King was a religious man. He was a pastor. He looked at racism and all of the so-called separate but equal laws and the terrible treatment of people of color in the United States. And he said, this is absolutely wrong. This is against God's will. This is not recognizing the dignity of peoples. And he made us all face that in very powerful ways.
On the eve of Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of a city bus in 1955, King was chosen to lead a citywide bus boycott. 2 years later, King and a group of civil rights activists formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to conduct nonviolent protests for civil rights.
When Martin Luther King led the Alabama boycott, that was a major turning point in the fight for civil rights. What you saw was people who had been fractionized coming together as one, walking together with others joining the fight. This was when people, America, the world, stood up and said, whoa, what are we looking at here? An amazing time.
Inspired by Gandhi's activism, King worked with the SCLC to organize black voters and civil rights protests. In 1963, King was arrested at a march in Alabama. During his prison time, King wrote a rebuttal to an article denouncing his methods. His longhand notes on the margins of the newspaper became known as Letter from Birmingham Jail, and was famously republished and studied in colleges across the country.
Martin Luther King was a man of God who believed that that calling necessitated social change in the present, and he put his life on the line for that calling.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
On August 28, 1963, King led more than 20,000 people in a massive demonstration at the Lincoln Memorial, where his speech, I Have a Dream, became a defining moment in civil rights history. Through his work, King helped pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and received the Nobel Peace Prize that same year.
Martin Luther King, according to Time in 1963, personified the civil rights movement. He took on one of the greatest challenges of his time and was one of the people that most influenced this very transformative time in American history.
Although King faced criticism from more militant black leaders, he continued his peaceful efforts toward both racial and economic justice. After delivering his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech at a rally in Memphis, King was assassinated the next day on April 4th, 1968, while standing at the balcony of his motel room.
King's assassination was, I think, devastating for many people. But there is also a rising level of organization, and many people, King's assassination galvanizes them into many kind of black power movements across the country, many anti-poverty movements. So it's both a moment of despair, but also a moment of political flowering.
Posthumously, King was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1977 and a Congressional Gold Medal in 2004. Today, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Holiday continues to be honored on the third Monday of every January.
We have prepared this morning a panel of Prairie members who participated in one way or another in the civil rights movement during the 1960s, introducing Mary Mullen, Eileen Nettleton, Bob Park, and myself, who will provide a brief description of our experiences during those times. Mary?
Actually, Barb, can you need to click on turn off the original sound for musicians temporarily when you're not singing. So, because otherwise we're going to get an echo.
Turn that off.
When you're not singing?
Yeah, we have to turn that off.
Yeah, can you do that?
There we go.
Technical things are happening. Are we ready?
No.
Is it off?
Are we changing
it? Sounds good
settings?
Now.
Yeah.
It
sounds good now.
Okay.
Sounds okay? Good. Okay.
All right. You're in front of the screen, though. All right. I'm Mary Mullen. The reason I was chosen to go first is because I participated in 1960, and then we're just going to go chronologically. So today what I want to tell you about is my time at Spelman College. It's a college for black women in Atlanta, Georgia. I was an exchange student there in the spring of my sophomore year from my college, which was North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. The year was 1960, and it was during that spring semester that black students started doing sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. I was a small-time preacher's kid from Waseca, Wisconsin, a town of about 600 in southwestern Wisconsin. In school, I'd been taught absolutely nothing about black history except that the Civil War had settled slavery. At home, my mother specifically taught us that every soul was equal regardless of color or class. You might know this song, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. That's what I was taught. I applied to be an exchange student only because my college roommate Ruth was applying, and she said, well, you should apply too. She was not selected. So in January 1960, I was on a train alone from Chicago to Atlanta, launching into a completely different culture. Most of the black women at Spelman, I found, were upper class and far more sophisticated than I was. And I was in a seat of black learning, five black institutions of higher learning clustered together there. Spelman for women, Morehouse College for men, Clark College, Morris Brown, and Atlanta University. I had no idea of what would start brewing that semester. On March 9, 1960, black student leaders from these institutions that I just named published an appeal for human rights. It's also known as a black manifesto in the Atlanta papers. One of the signers was Rosalind Pope. She was president of the student government at Spelman. And just this week, I learned the details of how that came about. Back in February of 1960, she sat in a drugstore drinking coffee, Morehouse College students Julian Bond, who you may know of, and Lonnie King came running in with a newspaper in Greensboro about the first black student sit-in at a Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. They wanted to create a student movement in Atlanta, so they stopped to talk to Rosalind, and by the end of the day, those three decided they would just start one. Rosalind was the one who actually wrote the appeal, And Julian Bond typed it on a typewriter of Professor Howard Zinn in his home, which was on the campus. I actually babysat Howard Zinn's kids and played tennis with him. The manifesto decried the discriminatory conditions in Atlanta and Georgia as a whole. So I had a very, very minor role in the protests. The Atlanta student leaders made plans to protest the situation at Rich's department store in downtown Atlanta. Part of the plan was to pair up a white student and a black student and to figure out or ascertain that Rich's would not serve blacks at eating facilities or a mixed group. I was asked to participate, and we were trained. Here's what we did. We rode the elevator up to the third floor lunch counter, and then we approached the lunch counter. It was that typical sort of soda jerk-like appearance with mirrors, signs, and milkshake-making equipment behind the counter. So together, this black girl and I came to the counter, and then I kind of choked out something like, we'd like to order here. Will you service? Can we sit down? The clerk behind the counter just couldn't believe her eyes. We could see that. She looked back and forth and back and forth. You know, she wasn't used to seeing a black person and a white person asking to be served together. And it dawned on her that that's what she was seeing, and that we were asking something that she was not permitted to allow, and probably she didn't want it to happen either. I remember feeling a little bit shaky, even though our training was not to challenge her, but just to ascertain that she wouldn't serve us. So we expected this, and so what we did then was turn to the very much fancier dining room. It's one of those that had a velvet rope attended by a doorman. But as we got closer to it, as we walked toward it, that doorman just picked up the velvet rope and drew it across the door and hooked it. On the other side, and so the dining room was closed. It was clear that we were being refused because there was a black person asking and because both of us were wanting to eat there together. I felt kind of insulted, but still in a way powerful, because we were just two 19-year-old college girls. See what power we had? Just by asking to sit down together, we were forced a closure of a very fine dining room. So we just turned away, went back to the elevator, and went back to campus. Nothing too exciting, but, you know, we ascertained we couldn't be served. And then the only other challenge that I presented in Atlanta was to pound on the door of an express bus in a panic to be let off at the Spelman campus, which wasn't a stop. Well, you know, as a small town girl, I had never ridden on a city bus before, and I had gone downtown on the proper bus because I told which one was the one to take, and that I would just take it back, but I didn't notice it was express. And if I even noticed it, I wouldn't have known that. So I'm pounding on the door because they're going past my stop at Spelman College, and I wouldn't have known how to get back to it from another stop. Well, all the white people, which was probably all there were there on the bus, that raised a lot of eyebrows, I think, but the bus driver took pity on me and opened the door and let me out. And then in Charleston, South Carolina, I went with my roommate to spend the vacation. And I rode in a car with black kids my age to a party at the home of a well-off black family. It was dark when we were going there, but all my black companions were just nervous as cats because what would they say if they were stopped and I was found in the same car, a white person with a bunch of black other people? So I don't have time now to detail much about this experience, how it manifested itself in my future actions, but just in brief, as both a high school English teacher in the 1960s and a fourth grade teacher from 1992 to 2005, I taught units of black history. In the 1980s, I took a trip to Mississippi with Project Help, Self-Help and Awareness, and then I reported on that at Prairie later. And then in 2009 and 2010, I mentored black women in the Marlboro Community Garden. And a few years ago, I volunteered, it's probably 2 years ago or three now, I volunteered for Prairie's committee, study committee in widening the circle of concern. And I say that, no, at the present time, my contributions are mainly to donate money to organizations that are working to provide education and aid to people who've been victims of discriminatory policies. All these things are pretty minor in the grand scheme of things, but I feel they're something at least. So that's my story.
I'm the last.
Thank you, Mary. Now Eileen Nettleton will explore her experiences with us in the 1960s. Eileen?
Thank you. My summer civil rights work project took place during what was called there in the movie, The Amazing Time. It was the summer after the Washington, D.C. Demonstration and Martin Luther King's famous speech. It was the summer of 1964, after my sophomore year of college, the height of the civil rights movement. That summer was specifically the Mississippi Freedom Summer, when many students went south to register African Americans to vote. Our Methodist campus ministry and other groups at Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, Washington, organized civil rights marches to support equal rights. One student was headed to Mississippi. I applied instead to take part in the Ecumenical Civil Rights Project in Roxbury, Boston, since I was frankly afraid to go volunteer in Mississippi with the ongoing arrests and violence towards civil rights activists there. And as you heard, I was correct about that and avoiding that summer there. I joined the group of eight college students and a campus minister, Catholic, Episcopal, Presbyterian, and Methodist, who lived, cooked, and met regularly and talked in the Norfolk House, a former settlement house, in the center of Roxbury. Roxbury had become the home of many immigrants and African Americans in Boston. We were assigned to local service projects in the community. Mine were tutoring, reading, and teaching piano one-to-one at Blue Hill Community Center each morning, then walking to a temporary office to type up reports of housing code violations observed and documented by two other members of our project. Our reports were sent on to the Massachusetts State Attorney General, Edward Brooks, who later became the first Black governor of Massachusetts. The quote office we worked out of was the living room of Philip, a 30-something African-American man who ran his small protest organization against slumlords, adeptly and respectfully. We white committed college students widened our education to include a fuller understanding of the disparities in living situations between classes and races, as we documented complaints of no working locks on doors, no working lights in hallways, and cockroaches under kitchen sinks. I experienced being the only white person around as I walked the neighborhood streets to my volunteer assignments, generally observed but ignored by elders sitting on front stoops or kids playing in the neighborhood. Being in the minority was a new experience for a small town girl from Ohio and Washington. Two experiences stand out in my memory. One was joining other civil rights activists from Boston on a bus to Atlantic City to march through the city and on boardwalk outside the Democratic Presidential Party convention. Our signs and chants demanded seating the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party of Fannie Lou Hamer and others in place of the all-white Democratic delegates. This did not happen, but there was a lot of TV coverage of the protest, and Johnson, who was nominated and elected president, did enact many great society and civil rights reforms. It was very exciting to be part of the larger movement for social and racial equity. The other event was attending the memorial service for Unitarian Minister civil rights activist James Reeb, who had just been killed in Mississippi for organizing voter registration events. He was a Unitarian minister in the Boston area. The service our group attended was held in a neighboring Black church with deep sorrow but hope as we sang together many of the familiar songs of the movement, including We Shall Overcome. It was a poignant mixed race event and truly ecumenical. I am constantly reminded of the importance and sacrifice of Reverend James Reeb here in Madison, as I was on the committee representing Prairie with Madison Unitarian Universalists in the 70s who helped form the third UU congregation that decided to name its congregation on his behalf. In terms of my background, why did I ever get involved in this? Well, my own parents had integrated their Ohio small town Methodist church in the 50s and were lifelong friends with one of these families. The Summer Civil Rights Project experience strengthened my own personal commitment to work for equality and social justice. As a reading specialist in the Madison schools, I worked with teachers to include multicultural literature in reading materials and evaluate textbooks for the inclusion of children whose faces reflected those of our students. I used books such as a biography of Jackie Robinson when demonstrating teaching methods in classrooms with mixed race groups of students. I felt comfortable teaching children from across racial groups when I worked in schools with 20 to 40% African American, Hmong, Hispanic, or international students, and with teachers of various races and backgrounds. And then during my term as president of the board of our League of Women Voters of Dane County, we adopted a diversity, equity, inclusion policy. I'm very impressed with the outreach of the League in voter registrations events across all communities in our area and the inclusion of social and racial equity in our educational public forums. My experiences of 1964 allowed me to see the world through different eyes and expand my connection with people of many different backgrounds while being part of a major historical movement. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen. Now Bob Park will tell us about his fascinating experiences during the civil rights movement. Bob?
Okay. My UU connection began around 1963 as a graduate student when I joined the Channing Murray Club, which was the Unitarian Universalist group on campus. And it was also the year that Medgar Evers was assassinated near Jackson, Mississippi. He was the Mississippi's first field secretary for the NAACP, and his older brother, Charles Evers, took over that position after Medgar was killed. Medgar also was had called on Edwin King, Reverend Edwin King, to come back from Massachusetts to Mississippi to help with the civil rights movement. Ed King was a white Mississippian who had been involved in civil rights for a number of years, and six days after Medgar Evers was assassinated, Ed King was driven off the road and into a crash, which scarred his face and took years for him to recover. He at that time had just taken over as chaplain and dean of students at Tougaloo College, which I'll talk about later. 1963 was also the year in September when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham was bombed, killing the four little girls. 1964 was the year I became president of the Channing Murray Club, and that's the year when the three civil rights workers disappeared in Mississippi at the beginning of Freedom Summer, when they had gone down to investigate burning of a black church. It wasn't until August of 1964 that their bodies were found after a tip had been received by the FBI. That was also the year that I met Orloff Miller at a student religious liberals leadership training conference, and Orloff Miller the following year sent out a telegram to Unitarian groups, including in our Channing Murray Club, calling for people to come down and join the last day of the March on Montgomery, which Martin Luther King had organized and was leading. That march had first started after Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in Mississippi in 1965, prior to what was called Bloody Sunday, when marchers tried to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge and were beaten back by police. Eventually, the march, after the national attention was received, the march did proceed to Montgomery, and two of us went down as representatives of the Channing Murray Club in response to the telegram from Orloff Miller. And Orloff Miller was one of the two UU ministers who was with James Reeb when the three of them were attacked, and the attack which led to the death of James Reeb. We attended a rally the night before the final day. When we went to Alabama, we were hosted by the Unitarian Church in Birmingham, Alabama. They gave us training in nonviolent protection and housed us in their homes and took us on chartered buses to the rally that Martin Luther King spoke at in the Montgomery area. The following day, we were bused back again for the final 3 miles of the march on Montgomery, led by Martin Luther King. Then that was in March of 1965. In June, I returned to Mississippi as a volunteer for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to Jackson, Mississippi. And 3 days after arriving, I was arrested with about 470 some people for participating in a march on the Capitol in Jackson. This was a very peaceful march, not in the streets but along sidewalks, stopping to let traffic go when there was a stoplight. We were stopped by police before we reached the Capitol and told, step out of the line or you'll be arrested. And we were arrested and hauled off to state fairgrounds in Jackson. Medgar Evers' brother Charles Evers, who was one of those arrested about the second day, and I got to meet him briefly enough to shake his hand. Over 1,000 people were arrested under the Jackson police policy of instant arrest, and the crime was parading without a permit. Went through the courts, and eventually that law, as it was used in Mississippi, was declared unconstitutional, and it became easier then to get a permit to parade in Jackson than it was in Madison at the time. After getting out of the 10 days in the fairgrounds exhibition hall where the men were held, I helped to organize Freedom Schools and started one in Jackson. I was using as the basis for the Freedom School book called Before the Mayflower, which was first published in 1962, and I just got this from the library. This is the 8th edition, much expanded from the first edition. The 8th edition was in 2007. And anyone who wants to get a good review of a history of Black history in America, this 800-page book is a good start. Shortly after, 2 weeks after returning from my summer in Mississippi, while I was there, I attended a Unitarian Fellowship, UU Fellowship of Jackson, Mississippi, and they had an extension minister hired by the UUA to help. He was Donald Thompson, and 2 weeks after back to Wisconsin, I heard that he had been shot in the parking lot of the apartment where I had enjoyed a dinner at his place. He was wounded with multiple injuries from a shotgun and recovered, and with threats on his family, decided to leave Mississippi, and he returned to Boston, where he worked in the Roxbury area. My next contact with the civil rights movement was when I went to teach for a semester at Tougaloo College that I'd learned about from Ed King. When I got to Tougaloo College, the president of the college greeted me and said with some pride how the KKK had burned a cross on the lawn of the college. Some have described the Tougaloo College as the center of the unofficial center of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. My own involvement there was, I was completely involved in preparing and teaching classes, but my car was used by organizers who went out into the community to organize. So that's my part.
Thank you, Bob.
So we'll take questions.
Thank you, Bob.
I have a short piece on my experience during the 1960s. In 1966, as a member of the Evanston Unitarian Church, I served as the chair of the Social Action Committee. It was a time when many of the members of the congregation were actively engaged in demonstrations and protesting against unfair housing practices that were preventing Blacks from buying homes in a major part of the city. Some historical background helps understand why this was such a major issue. Blacks were in Evanston arriving in the 1850s, and by 1880, there were approximately 125 African Americans in Evanston, and that number grew to 730 in 1900. At that time, many of the African Americans in Evanston worked in domestic and personal services. In the years from 1900 to 1940, during the Great Migration of African Americans from the rural South to the urban North, the Black population of Evanston grew to over 6,000 in 1940. That was according to the census. And in an article by Andrew Weiss about segregation in Evanston published in the Journal of Social History, unlike many suburbs that sought to exclude African Americans altogether, leading members of Evanston's real estate establishment played a role in the growth of Evanston's large African American community. Weiss states that Evanston was different in this respect from other suburbs around Chicago. Evanston was already home to a well-established African American community by the time of the Great Migration. In addition, he says, African-American workers supplied labor that was in demand by white elites in Evanston, and they had personal ties with many of the white families that they worked with or worked for. There was one major caveat, according to Weiss. Evanston's white real estate brokers apparently developed a practice of informal racial zoning. In effect, they treated a section of West Evanston as open to African Americans while excluding them from the rest of the town. If you see this on your screen, that red part and just below it is the large location where African Americans reside. In 1964, Dr. Martin Luther King came to Evanston, and after a number of marches and demonstrations, a community relations commission began to explore the possibility of open housing in Evanston. In September 1964, the commission found that more than one half of the white respondents preferred to live in a neighborhood that was 100% white. 72% of black respondents preferred to live in a neighborhood that was half black and half white. The commission also found that some real estate brokers were refusing to let properties for homeowners who wanted to sell on a non-discriminatory basis, and some declined to represent black homeowners. The commission concluded that housing was the most troublesome issue facing the city, and it drafted a proposed fair housing ordinance. A group of homeowners and a group of real estate brokers quickly formed to oppose the open housing ordinance. Homeowners argued the ordinance violated their First Amendment right to determine with whom they would deal. The group of brokers argued that fair housing would accelerate a shift of neighborhoods from all white to all black and cause property values to drop. In 1965 and into 1966, there were continued demonstrations in support of open housing, but continued opposition. And I remember marching in those demonstrations and packing the city hall when the city council was meeting. In 1966, the city council passed an open housing ordinance by a vote of 18-8. But it was vetoed by the mayor. A year later, in October 1967, the council passed a stronger housing ordinance by a vote of 11-7. That ordinance prohibited brokers from discriminating or accepting discriminatory listings, but it did not cover property owners, financial institutions, banks, or real estate agencies. And then after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, a large number, over 3,000 Evanston residents, marched from Emerson Street and McCormick Boulevard through the downtown area and gathered at Raymond Park for a memorial service. And one minister was there who urged the immediate passage of an effective end and comprehensive housing law. On April 11th, 1966, Congress passed the Federal Fair Housing Act, prohibiting discrimination in housing on the basis of race. And on April 29th, 1968, 200 people packed Evanston City Council chambers, and there were another 600 of us outside. I remember being outside. I didn't get inside that day. Council passed the Fair Housing Ordinance by a vote of 15-1. That one was stronger than one adopted in 1967, but it still had limitations. While adoption of fair housing laws was a major step forward, housing discrimination did not end in Evanston. For example, in 1989, the city fined 8 real estate firms for violating the city's fair housing ordinance by racial steering. And just a few years ago, in 2019, Evanston, Illinois became the first place in the United States to devise a plan to provide reparations to Black residents to address racial discrimination that they had experienced in housing. On this day, when Dr. Martin Luther King would be celebrating his 95th birthday, we are still reaching for the realities of his dream. It's now time for our community to take an opportunity for discussion around the focus of our service today. Relying upon a covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure all voices are welcomed and our relationships are valued. Please click on view, then gallery view to see everyone on your screen. Please raise a virtual hand, which is located under the reactions button on Zoom. I will call on you, then unmute yourself and ask your question or comment. Introducing yourself with your name and pronouns is welcome. Any comments, questions for any of the panelists? There's Robin. Robin Proud.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody. I had been pushing for a program like this for some time because we have firsthand people who were involved. I was about 10 years younger, and so wasn't involved in the same way at that time. And I'm sorry we don't have more high school students right now that I think would be really valuable for them to know about. The video said that there were 20,000 people in Washington, and it was 250,000.
Yes.
The reason I know that number is because Dan and I just watched this terrific movie, Rustin, on Netflix. Yes. About a person lesser known in the movement because of his personal life. But it also shows that even within that movement, there were different factions, there were things to deal with. And the video, of course, had to be very short. Didn't mention all the threats against King, bombing of his home and so on, tapping of his phone. And also there's a tendency to prettify him that now conservative people say, oh, he was such a good figure. These uppity people today should be more like him. But at the time, they denounced him as a communist, a travel baker, tried to publicize that he had affairs with women, or insinuate that he had an affair with a man, anything to discredit him. And we also tend to forget that he was working for economic equality. The march was actually called March for Jobs and Freedom, right? And he was against the Vietnam War. So there was it's sometimes just a simple version that people get. But I really appreciate everybody sharing their experiences.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Kent, you have your hand. Kent, I recognize you.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, you know, obviously I was a little young to kind of have really participated in the main part of the civil rights movement. But during most of the 60s, when I was young, my family lived in Pittsburgh. And I guess the main thing that I really remember, well, there were various, protests in Pittsburgh during the 60s. But the thing I remember most is just a day or two after Martin Luther King was assassinated, my parents and I participated in this big candlelight vigil. In downtown Pittsburgh. My sister didn't get to go because I guess my parents thought she was too young, but apparently 6 years old was old enough to participate in that. So that's kind of my biggest really specific memory of the civil rights era.
Hey.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to add a couple of things about some other prairie connections. One of our founding members, Fran Remyka, was extremely active. She was a realtor, and she was extremely active in the Madison Fair Housing, the passage of Fair Housing Ordinance in Madison. Before that, she got chastised by the Realtors Association because she was selling homes to African Americans outside of the small area in South Madison where Gary and Pam live, where Blacks were allowed to buy a home. There's even a chapter about her in the book by Muriel Sims on oral history of African Americans in Madison. And Fran Remyka is one of two non-Blacks who is interviewed. Another one was Taliaferro, who was a member of our congregation. He bought a house right on the corner up the street from us. Yeah. But there's a story about that for some other day.
And Bayview.
And she was also one of the founding members of the Bayview Housing Project, which is a nonprofit housing, which is still extremely successful and has raised millions of dollars in the past few years to expand housing in the Triangle, where the former community of African American and Italians had been torn down. The other thing I wanted to mention was, if you remember Peg Barrett, her husband, Will Hayes, his brother was one of the people that's in the Mississippi burning, Michael Shermer, I think. And he's one of the people who's memorialized with a painting on the mural in the basement of the Montgomery Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King was working at that time. So it... again, in retrospect, I think I wasn't nearly as brave as Bob, and I'm really glad I had my little Boston experience. One other thing I want to mention is that the family that I referred to, that my family knew well from the 50s, they were the first friends who welcomed us when we came to Madison. He had come here as the executive director for the Urban League. And when we got to Madison, they were the family. It was an African-American family living not far from where Gary and Pam are, because that's the only place they could live. Even though he was the executive director of the Urban League, they welcomed us to Madison.
Thank you, Eileen. Ann Pryor, you had a comment, a question.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, so much. From this perspective in my life, I keep thinking about your parents and what they must have felt with your youthful diligence and bravery and going into known dangerous times out of your strong convictions that they helped you create. So I'd love to hear about that. But then also several of the places that y'all mentioned in your stories. I visited a few years ago, a buddy and I, Meg Gaines, created a civil rights tour that we went on. And, you know, the Woolworths counter in Greensboro is there to visit. The monuments in Selma, the monument to the bridge, the James Reeb memorials, very non-official, very organically created. The State Museum in Jackson now really wrestles with this history and official role in the racism practices and policies that were there. It's really moving. Bryan Stevenson's Legacy Museum in Montgomery, talking about lynching and the memorial that's there. It's a secondhand way to experience some of the places and the events that you all experienced firsthand that can be really powerful. I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Ann. It is now, time for us to end our discussion. We will be postponing our offering until next Sunday, and we'll be closing with these words by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. Our closing music is We Shall Not Be Moved, accompanied by Barbara Park, Dan Proud, The lyrics will be in the chat.
We're getting our act together here as the change of the guard here. Okay, are we ready?
Yep.
We shall not be moved.
We have a few announcements. Just a reminder for everyone to bring your guest at your table container back to Prairie. If you haven't received it yet, we have extras of these available, but we will be concluding this project by the end of January. So please remember, guest at your table. Next Sunday, we will be welcoming Reverend Anthony Wade, who's pastor of the Second Baptist Church, which is the congregation that we share our block together. He's the pastor at Second Baptist, and he'll be speaking next Sunday at Prairie on a focus on loving one another and drawing inspiration from the scriptures of the King James Bible. There are more announcements in the News of the Week email. At this time, we stop the recording.